Arsenic is a highly toxic carcinogen and is the most significant chemical contaminant in drinking water globally, according to the World Health Organization. Chronic exposure to arsenic has been shown to damage almost every system in the human body, resulting in conditions like heart disease, diarrhea, cognitive impairment, cirrhosis, and lung disease, among others. We actually know very little about inequalities in public drinking water quality across the United States. Ann Nijra, environmental health scientist at Columbia University and the lead author of the paper, told EHN. She added that these contamination levels across different communities in the U.S. are really important data points to collect. With these measurements, you can see where inequalities lie and further study how that exposure is related to disease. Primarily Hispanic communities, smaller populations of about 1,000, and areas in Southwest were more likely to have arsenic concentrations in drinking water that exceeded the Environmental Protection Agency maximum contaminant level, raising environmental justice concerns. The maximum contaminant level is the highest concentration of a contaminant that is allowed in drinking water. The EPA determines these levels by considering the public's health, but also the cost and feasibility of achieving and enforcing that standard. Nijra and her team studied records from 2006 to 2011 because that was when the EPA began following up and enforcing their new lowered thresholds for arsenic in water. The EPA announced in 2001 that the maximum contaminant level would go from 50 parts per billion to 10 parts per billion to be enforced by 2006. Parts per billion may be significantly lower than 50 parts per billion, but Nijra said that's not enough. The Netherlands has established a regulatory limit of 1 part per billion in drinking water. Denmark, New Hampshire, and the state of New Jersey have all established a regulatory standard of 5 parts per billion, she said. Many counties exceed even that. The study results showed that there are still close to 500 counties whose arsenic levels cross that threshold. It's a great health concern, said Nijra, because there is no safe level of arsenic in drinking water. The EPA's maximum contaminant level goal is 0 parts per billion. Arsenic may not accumulate in the body the way other elements, like lead or mercury, do, said Nijra, but if you are being exposed to arsenic through drinking water, that exposure is chronic. And chronic exposure, even at low to moderate levels of exposure, is a real problem, and it's a real threat to health.
The sworn enemy of the Iran nuclear deal will be leaving office very soon. The U.S. President Donald Trump, who unilaterally withdrew America from the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action in May 2018, left no stones unturned to completely destroy the JCPOA. Trump managed to significantly undermine the hard-earned international deal, but he failed to achieve his ultimate goal of killing the deal. Now, just weeks before Trump becomes a former U.S. president, the remaining signatories to the nuclear deal renewed their commitment this week to preserve it. The foreign ministers of Iran, China, Russia, Germany, France, and the United Kingdom agreed on Monday that no party should set fresh preconditions on a revival of the JCPOA. Their statement is believed to be paving the way for Washington and Tehran to come back into full compliance when Joe Biden takes office in January. Trump tried to destroy the deal by imposing tough sanctions and scaring off other countries from doing business with Iran. In response, Tehran has rolled back some of its JCPOA commitments. The next U.S. president will need to remove Trump's favorite sanctions against Iran, and Tehran, in return, will be expected to put back in place certain limitations on its nuclear program based on the JCPOA.
But if they return to the nuclear deal and into full compliance in action, Tehran will do the same by returning practically into full compliance. What is important here is that that return by the U.S. or some other parties to the nuclear deal into compliance, if it happens, theoretically, that will not suffice. What they need to do is that they return practically and in action.
The U.S. president-elect has pledged to restore the JCPOA when he takes office. Will America take this opportunity to rejoin international diplomacy and multilateralism? The Iranian Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif has repeatedly said that American sanctions deprived Iran of the benefits that his country is entitled to under the nuclear deal. Iran's top diplomat says the Europeans share the blame of the irreparable economic harm to Iranians. On Monday, Zarif took to Twitter after the meeting with his counterparts from China, Russia, Germany, France, and the UK. He posted a chart showing how trade between Iran and the EU has gone down over the past years, despite repeated European promises of better economic ties under the JCPOA. Zarif warned that this is a last chance for the Europeans to save the deal. The top diplomat said that Tehran will quickly reverse the measures that it took in response to the U.S. withdrawal and European breaches if they perform their duties well. Iranians are undoubtedly infuriated by the West's failure or unwillingness to properly implement the deal. Recently, Iran's parliament passed a piece of legislation that would prevent UN inspections of Iranian nuclear sites if sanctions are not eased within 2 weeks after Biden takes office. The new law would also require the administration to enrich uranium to the 20% level using advanced centrifuges. Some senior European diplomats, like the UK Foreign Secretary Dominic Raab, said that Iran should not further dilute its nuclear commitments. Some observers believe, however, that instead of lecturing Iran, the EU should immediately focus on how it can properly fulfill its own commitments.
I think the one side that can have demands is Iran, because after the withdrawal of the United States from the nuclear deal, that was Tehran who remained in the deal. Iran showed strategic patience for a year, and after that 1 year, Iran's reduction of commitments happened under the terms of the nuclear deal. So they have done the violation, and the Europeans were, despite their words and promises, were unable to compensate the U.S. withdrawal and exit from the nuclear deal.
Time is fast running out. Iran's top diplomat insists that no democratic country should expect the government to violate the deadline set by the recently approved parliamentary legislation.
It seems that the incumbent US President Donald Trump is keen to leave his mark on the presidency by pardoning some of the most horrific state crimes, with yet more anger raised by his most recent action. In his latest moment of absolution, Trump has officially given a pardon to the private security mercenaries from the so-called Blackwater security firm, a US company shrouded in controversy and shame over crimes committed by its personnel in Iraq. During the incident in Iraq in 2007, four Blackwater security personnel opened fire, threw grenades and used high-caliber weapons against a crowd of Iraqi civilians, killing 14 innocent, unarmed people, two of which were children. Following an investigation by parties including the FBI, the four guilty Blackwater murderers were sentenced to jail terms ranging from 30 years to life, something that many believe was too lenient, yet others thought were too harsh.
أتمنى من المحكمة الأمريكية بعد ما توصلت إلى هذا القرار قرار الإدانة أن تصدر قرارها بإعدام الجنات لأن هناك ما يقارب 20 عراقي أو 19 عراقي راحوا ضحية
In spite of the crimes committed by the four men, many people in the US fought to seek a pardon for them long prior to Trump announcing the plan, with the lawyer representing the criminals, Brian Heberlig, suggesting that the four did not deserve to spend 1 minute in prison for their crimes. One can only then question the rationale behind the reasoning of both Trump and the lawyer of the four murderers, especially when it comes to allowing such acts to happen, only for the powers that be allow for the criminals to get away with a crime and the ending of 14 innocent lives. There's a famous song that states that you can get by with a little help from your friends, and it seems that this is very much the case for the friends and partners of Donald Trump. Already Trump has pardoned some highly questionable figures in recent times, with many of them coming from the military or private sector background that enjoy close links to the president. Most recently, Trump has also pardoned Paul Manafort, Roger Stone and Charles Kushner, all close contacts and all sentenced for corruption and lies.
Thank you, Mr. President. Thank you for giving me the offer. Thank you for saving my life, because I don't think at my age and in my medical condition I would have survived in a COVID-infested prison. The president has said on numerous occasions that he thought there was a good chance I could be exonerated. I agree with that.
But it's Trump's links to Blackwater that raises questions, with Eric Prince, the founder of the company, not only being a close ally of Trump, but has also acted as an official representative of the president in the past, something that clearly shows that there's a link between the pardon and the two close friends. Yet the pardon also comes as no surprise, as in reality, the victims of the terrible crimes committed have all been in US-occupied lands, suggesting that Trump is continuing his discriminatory policy against non-white people, something that Trump has certainly become renowned for over the years. But for Trump, there's no doubt that his famous motto of Make America Great Again has failed. And after 4 years in the White House and his seemingly effortless ability to divide the nation at home and create tension abroad, Trump's true lasting legacy will be MARA, or in its full form, Make America Racist Again. The one impact that Trump has been able to deliver on, it seems. The United States has spent the last two decades fighting an endless and unwinnable war in Afghanistan, with the conflict costing the US billions each year, as well as a loss of life on both sides, reminding us all of the embarrassing defeat suffered by the US in Vietnam. But with the US slowly outstaying its welcome in West and Central Asia, as demonstrated by the Iraqi parliament voting to oust them, it seems that Washington is intent on leaving a lasting legacy in the region, particularly in Afghanistan. A secret CIA-trained hit squad known as Zero One has been trained in Afghanistan, with evidence suggesting that the group, who operated under the cover of darkness, are responsible for a series of extrajudicial killings and executions across the country, and most worryingly of all, against civilians. Reports from numerous eyewitnesses and survivors suggest that as many as 51 innocent civilians have been killed, with the youngest amongst them being only 8 years old, as the terror group targets schools, medical centres and other various institutions. With the raids apparently taking place across four districts in Afghanistan and with most of the victims having no links to the Taliban, the question arises as to whether there's some kind of partnership between the CIA-trained operatives and the Taliban. According to multiple reports, the US has broken multiple rules of war, breached human rights and has failed to deliver on any of the promises it made when it comes to building a secure Afghanistan. This raises the question as to just how the US can genuinely justify their presence in the country with so many operational failures in place.
The problem here, we're talking about the US presence in Afghanistan and what we call in this country collateral damage, is that there is no justification at this point after 18 years. We invaded Afghanistan allegedly to go after the Osama bin Laden, who it turns out was probably hiding in Pakistan. There was no way the Afghanistani government could accede to the demands that President Bush made when he made them in 2001. And, the justification is just not there. Now, after 18 years,
with attacks such as those completed by the Zero One unit, One official from the Afghan intelligence agency has stated that Americans have always been present during the 01 raids, but the official failed to distinguish between the blurred lines as to whether the unit were special forces, task forces, or quite simply, CIA agents. What's clear is that the US has a very shadowy modus operandi, and this is something that seems to allow them to get away with the murder of civilians in the process. With pressure mounting on the US to leave Afghanistan and Iraq, could training such groups by the CIA and US forces guarantee a proxy unit for the US military in the area once they've left? We know from the past that the CIA has a long history of interfering in various sovereign states, and in particular are keen to arm certain groups to the teeth in order to either justify their presence in an area or quite simply allow splinter groups to carry out the dirty work on behalf of Washington and Langley. In fact, when one looks into the money involved in performing such tasks, the figures are quite boggling, with the CIA allocating some $2.5 billion of their budget to covert operations alone, a sum that equates to around 5% of the total intelligence purse. But when some of the groups backed by the CIA are actually fighting back against the US, including killing its military personnel in the area, does this not create a notion of double jeopardy for the US, showing just how desperate they are when it comes to maintaining a foothold in places such as Afghanistan?
It's a question of desperation. The Trump administration met with the Taliban about a year ago or 2 years ago, as far as we can tell, and basically said, if you stop killing Americans, then we can get out of here, basically. We don't care who else you're killing, but don't kill us. And we can work something out, but if you're killing us and killing our troops, then we're never going to be able to withdraw from here, because we're not going to withdraw under fire. That's basically the United States position.
There may be many similar cases around the world that have yet to come to light. This report, however, has finally exposed the CIA as the main funding party behind the execution of civilians. What remains to be seen is whether such groups will remain US proxies in the future and continue to allow the US to carry out a series of illegal operations, all whilst being able to deny being present at the time.
Mujahideen Khalq Organization, MKO, also known as the MEK, is a notorious anti-Iran terror group that embraces an ideology that mixes Marxism and terrorism. MKO's crimes against Iran run the gamut from collaborating with Iraq's former dictator Saddam Hussein during the 1980 to 1988 war on Iran to a violent campaign of bombings across the country. One of the group's highest profile acts of terror came on June 20, 1981, when a powerful bomb went off at the headquarters of an Iranian political party, the Islamic Republican Party, where the party's leaders were holding a meeting. The bombing killed scores of Iranian officials, including the then head of Supreme Judicial Council, Ayatollah Mohammad Beheshti. Iran's army chief, Major General Mousavi, said there were traces of MKO involvement in the assassination of Iran's top scientist Mohsen Fakhrizadeh last month. The anti-Iran organization has long been recognized as a terror group by much of the international community. However, in June 2008, the United Kingdom crossed the group off its terror list. The move was followed by the European Union in 2009 and the United States in 2012. Canada followed in the footsteps of the Western countries in delisting MKO as a terror group in December 2012 without offering any reason for the decision.
There's no coincidence, because the conservative administration was in power at that time with the prime minister as Stephen Harper, and he was a pro-Zionist, pro-American type of politician. So whatever the Zionist lobbies wanted in Canada, he would work to implement that. Unfortunately, that the West has this double standard and hypocrisy that they use these groups to their benefit when they feel bankrupt.
Since removing its decade-long ban on the MKO, the Western nations, especially the United States, have used the group as a tool to pressure Iran. In September 2012, then U.S. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton said Washington was expunging the MKO from its list of designated terror organizations. The decision came after intense lobbying backed by prominent U.S. officials that included James Woolsey and Porter J. Goss, former CIA directors, Louis J. Free, the former FBI director, President George W. Bush's Homeland Security Secretary Tom Ridge, and Attorney General Michael Mukasey, and President Obama's first National Security Advisor, General James Jones. Many of the U.S. officials had been paid between $15,000 to $30,000 to deliver speeches to the group, as well as travel expenses to attend lavish rallies in Paris. Former Governor of Pennsylvania, Edward Rendell, said in 2012 that he had been paid a total of $150,000 to $160,000. In 2016 and 2017, Saudi Arabia's former spy chief, Prince Turki bin Faisal Al Saud, attended MKO meetings in Paris. Advanced with God's blessings, bin Faisal said in a speech in the 2016 meeting, wishing the terrorists success in attempting, quote, regime change in Iran.
But this is hypocrisy, because even the governments that come, I mean, the officials from different systems, such as the Saudi regime, you know, last year, a popular person from the Saudi regime came and said that he was in support of changing the system in Iran and bringing democracy, where we already know that Saudi Arabia is the furthest country from democracy. So how could somebody be supporting democracy when his own system itself is far away from democracy?
In 2018, another meeting in Paris attracted Rudy Giuliani, personal attorney to U.S. President Donald Trump, and Stephen Harper, a former Prime Minister of Canada. Pulitzer Prize winner Seymour Hersh reported in 2012 that a number of MKO members were secretly trained by the United States Joint Special Operations Command at the Department of Energy's Nevada National Security Site, a secretive training facility northwest of Las Vegas. The report was followed by another revelation in 2018 that the terrorists were receiving funds through Saudi smuggling networks and Saudi-linked black market sales to continue their subversive agenda. But what does this say about MKO supporters, except that they have become so desperate in their subversive attempts in Iran that they have turned to a cult group they once blacklisted as a terror organization?
Join us in this journey. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
La ilaha illallah, la ilaha illallah.
Answering your doubts and questions, and questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
Allah, who is Ar-Rahman? Allah, who is Al-Mannan?
La ilaha.
Please send us your emails through our email, which is englishradio@irib.ir.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Dear brothers and sisters, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh, and welcome to another program of questions and answers on the Islamic belief. I'm your host, Sayyid Wahid Alawi, and in the studio we have our dear scholar, Sayyid Muhsin Naqawi. Assalamu alaikum, Sayyid.
Alaykum assalam wa rahmatullah. Thanks for inviting.
Thank you for coming. The questions we have received here is about beliefs from you, dear listeners. And I would dive straight into the first question. My first question, dear Sayyid, is someone who doesn't believe in any religion, does that person X have ethics? Does that person X have morals? That's the first question. And the asker has asked a couple of questions in the question that person has posted to us. So let's answer this question first, and I would continue with the second and the third question that they have posted. Thank you.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Well, ethics is not related to any religion.
Right.
Every human being has ethics and morals. They have moral values and ethics.
Right.
What does religion does is, religion comes and it shines your ethics. It modifies you. It takes you. It takes you towards the perfection with those ethics that you have. On top of that, religion also introduced some, the greater level of ethics to those initial levels of ethics that every human being have. For example, it is unethical to say a lie in front of people. It
right.
is unethical to beat your kids. It is unethical to, for
abuse
example,
someone.
Bully or, yes, abuse someone.
Right.
These are all unethical
These are
things.
Commonalities.
These are commonalities.
Among all mankind.
What does religion do?
But what about zina, for example? That is something that is very different here.
That
has some person might say that it has nothing to do with ethics
what?
Or morals. I'm not doing anything bad. Why are you saying that that is bad?
Mm-hmm.
Well, our source goes back to the Prophet. His source does not go back to the Prophet of God. So we don't have any commonality
well,
here.
That's the point. The religion comes and it brings the boundaries and it takes you towards the perfection. It adds some other moral values into the ethics. For example, if someone says adultery before marriage or having a sexual relation with someone before marriage is not an unethical thing, they should refer back to the history. If they do not believe the religion, the books, or the prophets, they must refer back to the history. In the history, we see, for example, the ladies in the past had full clothes.
Right.
They were covering their full body. Even sometimes, you know, the Queen of England, she dressed like that. She had a big frog and she covers whole
right.
body. And even they used to cover their head. And they used to have some hats which has a kind of net veil,
right.
a veil made of net in front of that, with which they used to cover their faces as well. So all these things we can see in the history, they were there. With the passage of time, with the revolution that came with the liberalization, with the after the Renaissance,
right.
we can see these changes in the world that they come up with this modern world ideology. They come with this liberalization ideology, the women's right. All these things we see these changes that came into the world because of these changes. The way of living, the lifestyle of people, it also changed. Now, what is the role of religion here? The role of religion is that the main ethics, the common ethics, they were practiced in throughout the years or throughout the history by the people, by the mankind,
right.
in which the ones which are for sure they're the ethical things. Religion came with the boundaries that if this is an ethical thing, if it was in past, it should be now as well. If in the past lying was bad, it should be now. If in the past
yeah, but there are many things
adultery before
right.
the marriage wasn't allowed, it shouldn't be allowed now.
But there were many things in the past that were allowed and religion forbid that. How do you
what were they ethical things
that?
Or not?
Pardon?
Were they ethical things or not?
No,
moral things.
We're
talking about the ethics or the moral things.
Yeah, but there
if
were
they
some
were
ethical
unethical,
things that
even at that time, if they were
that
unethical.
Islam accepted, there were some ethical things that Islam did not. There were some immoral things according to Islam that Islam did not accept.
If it is immoral, there is a reason behind it. We can prove that.
But that was
immoral
from the Islamic perspective. It might not be immoral from someone else, perspective
well,
who is not within the.
That's why
of Islam.
I said you need to go back to the history. That was that immoral in the history before or not? Or with the passage of time, it became moral. There are many things that were immoral in the history, and now they became moral. For example, I should just give the example, like women cannot go without having the full like body covered
right.
in the past. But now we can see half a naked ladies outside on the street, even the boys as well. So there were some immoral things in the past, which became moral with the passage of time, which became moral with some changes that happened into this world. Because this man, we have a limited mentality, intellect, limited. We are limited. Obviously, we've been created by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. So with our this limited, we can say, like thinking, we have all these things in us. We change things around to see what fits us according to the time. But obviously, when it comes to the moral or the ethical things, religions, they look at the morals that are from, for example, Adam alayhi salam till the Qiyamah, till the Judgment Day.
Right.
So it covers everything. If there was something that was moral, even in the past, and if Islam comes and it obviously talks about its immorality, there is some reason behind it. We need to go back to the history to find out the patterns. So basically, when we talk about the ethics and unethical things, ethical and unethical things in religion and without religion, religion just comes and it introduces you some new, maybe, ethics. And also, it forbids that was basically unethical or immoral, maybe in the past, or it's in general. And the religion do not just comes and tell you that this thing is immoral and you should not do this. Religion also brings the reason for that.
Right.
And there is an intellectual reason. There is a reasoning behind it. And obviously, everyone accepts those reasons. You know, when you talk about these reasoning, that on these bases, religion comes and says, like, this act is immoral, everyone accepts it. But on top of that, they say, because our society do this, because in the society we do not see this
right
in that way, that's why we do this. And obviously, you know, about
today, the social norm has changed. Yes. No one would say that these things, for example,
still there are people. Still
zina
there are people
would be considered as,
for example,
something bad or negative in some societies.
For example, in the same societies, we have people who are, for example, the professors at the universities, they are the athletics, who still do not drink alcohol. Why?
Right.
Why they don't drink? They talk about the disadvantages of this.
Right.
They're not Muslim. They're non-Muslims.
Right.
Maybe they're atheists, but still. There are some people who do not commit, like, having a sexual relation before the marriage. Why? Because they are still looking, they see it as an ethical thing. Because this relation should be between a husband and wife. There is a, where we have, you know, the agreement between the husband and wife to live together and to have love for each other and all those. The rest is, you know, even the West says, the rest is lust only.
Right.
They also refer to these things. And they know that these are the things. Yes, the norms are changed. And that's the duty of religion. That's where the duty of religion starts. The religion comes and it tells you that if you want to live, we know that the norms will change, the way, the lifestyle will change, but you should limit yourself within these boundaries that are set. And you should not go beyond this. Because if you go beyond this, there's a danger. There is a danger of corruption in the society. And that's why we see a lot of corruption in the society as well. The more the norms are changing, the more the social life is changing, the corruption is increasing as well. And today we have the surveillance system, CCTV, maybe the cameras,
right,
the I don't know, the police, there are the human resource, there are the electronical resources that we are using. And with all these things, still we can see why all these things are happening, because the norms are changing and the corruption is increasing as well.
All right. Let's go to the second question of this dear listener. And that is this ethics that we are talking about, these ethical issues that we are talking about, is that specific for Islamic belief or faith, or no, other religions have a similar ethical code?
Well, this ethics that we are talking about is not specified to Islam, as we just mentioned. Like, the ethics is not specified to a religion. We have some common ethic or morals in our life. But obviously, Islam comes with some extra ethical, you can say, rulings and the ethical points, which helps you to go towards the perfection. In the other religions, we do also see these ethical things. For example, in Hinduism, it was unethical for any woman to be at home without something on their head.
Even at home?
even at home. For example, if it was like daughter-in-law, obviously, you know, in India, they have a combined family system. In there, if daughter-in-law comes in front of the father-in-law without having a veil on the or a scarf on the head, it was unethical, and they would see her with the bad eyes. It would considered as unethical thing.
Really?
There are some specific ethics for each religion.
Right.
They have these things. For example, even in the same Hindu religion, if I want to give example, I'm giving the example of Hindu religion specifically. Why? Because it is a religion that brings, like, obviously partner for Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Because if I talk about the Judaism or
it
Christianity, partner for Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. It's the, like, being a mushrik or polytheist. These are not the religion that are came from Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Because, you know, when we talk about...
But if you would have asked Hindus, they would say we are a monotheistic religion.
No, they don't
and,
say
those
that.
And those that we call idols are what we call the manifestations of
it's
the one God.
Currently, they do say this, but previously they were not saying this. You know, in the philosophical discussions that they got involved into the inter-religion discussions and all those, they have started saying this. But obviously we know that the books that they have, these are not the books from Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Because we have a term that we use, Ahlul Kitab, the people of book, in which we consider like Jews, Christians and Muslims. Because they have Torah, they have Bible and the Quran, it's all sent by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. So that's why I was giving the example of the Hinduism, because it's not Ahlul Kitab. They say everything after death, it becomes the part of Wahdatul Wujud, and they become the part of this universe. They talk about Wahdatul Wujud not in the sense which we think, because they say, like, if you get the moksha, like free from this world, from this circle of
incarnation,
then you become the part of the God itself. Like the Sufis, they say, like, you're in God. That's what they have. And the Sufis, obviously, they have the same concept. That's not the Wahdatul Wujud that we have. It's different from that. I was giving the example of the Hinduism. Obviously, they have the moral and ethics as well. So this ethics and moral, it's not specific to one religion. But yes, the religion that gives you the most perfect, we can say, the ethical guidance, the more perfect, you can say, moral guidance or the rulings that it has, that is Islam, because Islam is the completion of all religions, all the ilahi religions that were sent by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. So because about Islam, Allah says, like, today there is a verse in the Quran that we have completed this religion. So it's the completion. So when Islam is the completion of all the religions, all the ilahi or the God's religion, then obviously Islam has the whole or the complete set of ethical and moral, we can say, rulings in it. So that's why if we follow Islam, it's better. Why? Because we will obviously travel, or we go towards the perfection quickly if we follow these ethical,
inshallah. Or what the Prophet said in his famous narration, a famous saying, that I have come to complete the moral ethics.
Moral ethics.
Right?
Yes.
That's the culmination of moral ethics. Islam is the culmination of that, of all the old traditions.
All the old traditions. It's the completion of all the old traditions and morals.
All right. Thank you very much, Sayyid. And thank you, dear listeners, for joining us in this program of questions and answers on the Islamic belief. Till next time, may Allah's peace and blessings be upon all of you.
إن في الجنة نهر اللبن لعلي وحسين وحسن لعلي وحسين وحسن إن في الجنة نهر اللبن إن في الجنة نهر اللبن لعلي حسين وحسن لعلي وحسين وحسن حب أهل البيت فرض عندنا حب أهل البيت فرض عندنا وبها
The United States has been waging a brutal campaign of economic warfare against Iran, also known as the Maximum Pressure Campaign. These sanctions have had a devastating effect on the country's economy and civilian population. I'm Richard Medhurst, and this is The Communique. In 2015, the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, also known as the Iran Nuclear Deal, was signed by Iran and the P5 plus one, meaning the United States, the UK, France, China, Russia, plus Germany. This agreement set out the framework whereby sanctions against Iran would be lifted in exchange for Iran curbing its nuclear capabilities. And indeed, Iran complied fully with the agreement. This was verified by the United Nations nuclear watchdog, the International Atomic Energy Agency. And in 2016, all oil and financial sanctions were lifted, releasing almost $100 billion to Iran in frozen assets. However, in 2018, Donald Trump unilaterally pulled the United States out of the Iran nuclear deal, claiming that Iran was violating the agreement. This, of course, was not true, and no one shared this view, not the United States' own European allies, nor the international inspectors from the IAEA. The Trump regime then moved to reimpose crippling sanctions targeting Iran's oil sector, aircraft exports, precious metals, construction imports, and financial transactions. What the Trump regime wanted was to renegotiate the deal with Iran in order to dismantle Iran's ballistic missile program and to stop Iran from supporting resistance efforts in the Middle East. Effectively, what the United States did here is go back on its own word, not even 3 years after striking this deal, and then with such overt and brazen greed proceed to ask for even more concessions. This proves that there never really was an existential threat or fear of Iran obtaining a nuclear bomb like we heard so often and still do. What Washington wants is for Tehran to abandon its ballistic missiles program because this benefits Israel and Saudi Arabia. Moreover, Washington would love to limit Tehran and contain Iran's influence in the region, preventing Iran from fighting the illegal occupation of Palestine, Lebanon, Syria, and Iraq by the Zionists and the Americans. So, of course, the United States resorts to lies, to propaganda, and ridiculous smears using the mainstream media as its vehicle, which reminded me of the days in the lead-up to the invasion of Iraq in 2003 when they were constantly talking about weapons of mass destruction, 24/7. Now they have a new slogan, a new catchphrase, but for Iran, where they say, Iran is the world's leading state sponsor of terrorism. And they try to use that in order to justify their imperialist aggression and conquest. Iran is no stranger to U.S. sanctions, but the Trump administration has been running what it calls the Maximum Pressure Campaign, led by Secretary of State Mike Pompeo. This Maximum Pressure Campaign is designed to exert as much pressure and wreak as much havoc as possible on the economies of countries that the United States has targeted for regime change, just like Iran, just like Syria, Venezuela. And this always results in widespread suffering and death for the civilian population. Simply put, this is economic terrorism. This is a modern version of siege warfare. And it is cruel, it is inhumane, and it is illegal under international law. After leaving the JCPOA, we've seen the United States slap Iran with new sanctions almost every week. The U.S. has been so adamant in trying to put new sanctions on Iran that it even tried to trigger snapback sanctions at the United Nations Security Council earlier this year in August and bring back this U.N. arms embargo that consequently expired in October. This motion failed miserably, and it was a huge diplomatic embarrassment for the United States. Out of the 15 members who sit on the UN Security Council, the United States and the Dominican Republic were the only ones who voted for the resolution, with the other 13 members either voting against it or abstaining. This desperation was made even more obvious by the fact that the U.S.'s own allies, France, the U.K., and Germany, abstained from the vote. U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo and U.S. Ambassador to the U.N., Kelly Craft, insisted that they would be re-implementing UN sanctions on Iran, despite the UN not being on board and voting the resolution down. There were no UN sanctions returning on Iran. The arms embargo expired. But because there is such a lack of international support in order to save face, that's what they've been saying. And it just proves how pathetic and farcical this entire campaign is. Just to further underscore how ardent the US has been in its pursuit of economic warfare against Iran, Donald Trump's national security advisor, Robert O'Brien, even said that the U.S. has imposed so many sanctions on Iran that there's, quote, very little left for us to do. Iranian Foreign Minister Javad Zarif tweeted a few days ago, quite accurately, I might add, that the United States is addicted to sanctions. I think it's putting it mildly. Just to further underscore this sustained campaign of aggression against Iran, not only did the U.S. pull out of the JCPOA, it also assassinated Iran's top general, Qasem Soleimani, and Iraqi commander Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis. The U.S. then flew a drone into Iranian airspace, violating Iran's sovereignty, and then issued a rebuke in response when Iran shot down, rightfully so, their unmanned aircraft. They've also threatened to pirate Iranian shipments of fuel to Venezuela, who's also struggling under brutal sanctions by the U.S. And in a separate incident, we also saw U.S. jets harass a civilian commercial airliner from Mahan Air that was flying over Lebanese airspace. These provocations are no accident and have been designed to complement this maximum pressure campaign. Nonetheless, the implications are not all military. The results of these sanctions can be felt in all areas of life. What the United States and their allies would like you to believe is that sanctions are some kind of harmless tool, a dull blade wielded in order to exert political pressure. But the reality on the ground is that scores of civilians end up starving and suffering and dying at the hands of these brutal sanctions, this economic terrorism. Let's call it for what it is. We've seen this before when the U.S. killed untold numbers of children in Iraq with sanctions in the early 90s. We're seeing this right now in Syria with the brutal Caesar Act sanctions, causing people to wait in breadlines in a country that was once self-sufficient in food. We're seeing this in Venezuela where people have no fuel and nothing to eat. 40,000 people minimum have died already because of U.S. sanctions. And we're seeing this now as well in Iran. We're seeing the effect there as well, where people are forced to go without medicine during a pandemic. Iran's health minister, Namaki, said earlier this month that the sanctions imposed on Iran by the U.S. have targeted medicine and medical equipment. Now, even though the United States claims its sanctions don't target things like medicine or medical supplies or food, European and other international partners end up being dissuaded from trading with Iran out of fear of retaliation and being slapped with secondary sanctions. In October of this year, the United States moved to sanction Iran's entire financial sector, blacklisting 18 of its banks, shutting it out completely of global markets and making it extremely difficult for businesses and, more importantly, for the government to buy medicine and medical supplies. How can countries like the United States and the United Kingdom profess to be liberal democracies who uphold international law and oppose tyranny when they are responsible for murdering scores of innocent civilians with their barbaric siege warfare? Never mind the wars, never mind the bombings, the drone strikes, the invasions. It seems that their idea of bringing democracy to others entails starving off entire populations and putting them through unspeakable misery. The fact that one would do this at any time is cruel enough. But the fact that the United States has not only continued the sanctions, but increase them during a global pandemic further exposes how brutal their foreign policy is and further proves this point. The United Nations and numerous other international bodies have all called on the U.S. to end its brutal sanctions, to end this ridiculous maximum pressure campaign amid the coronavirus crisis, calls that the United States has completely and utterly ignored. The sanctions are so severe that they have spurred the growth of a black market, leaving Iranians without medicines that they desperately need or being forced to pay obscene amounts just to obtain them. How can anyone justify such economic and medical terrorism? We'll be right back after this short break.
Communique is a program in which Richard Medhurst, the independent journalist and political commentator, gives his views of controversial issues of our time and interviews famous politicians and personalities. This program is broadcast every Sunday by IRIB English Radio.
Joining me now to talk more is Dr. Said Sarkar, Professor of Medical Physics at Tehran University of Medical Sciences. Thank you for coming on, Professor. I wanted to ask you, the United States claims that its sanctions don't target humanitarian goods like medicines and food. How have U.S. sanctions impacted Iran's ability to obtain drugs, medical equipment, and medical supplies?
The U.S. sanction really has paralyzed the Iranian health sector. When they try to buy some special equipment or some pharmaceuticals or devices for patients, they are not able to do so. Although they say there is no sanction on health sector, but anyway, we cannot transfer money because all the sanctions through on the Iranian banks, which are not able to transfer money to the companies who they from they buy their facilities. Is that somehow that they say, okay, you are allowed to buy things or get hold of these pharmaceuticals? They block the way. So it's untouchable or unreachable because if you want to buy them, you have to pay them, pay the companies. And also the companies are worried after their sale, they will be punished by the U.S. Authorities. This is really terrible. This sanction has paralyzed us and has a profound effect on our health sector, and really people are suffering from these sanctions, and they have taken the Iranian nation as economic hostage, and really they are blackmailing Iranian population to impose their will on our nation.
I believe President Rouhani also said that these U.S. sanctions are preventing Iran from obtaining a COVID vaccine from the World Health Organization. Could you elaborate on that for us?
Yes, that's right. They are, they have been trying to buy this COVID vaccine from several weeks ago, and unfortunately, they have not been able to transfer money to pay for the cost of these vaccines. And also, as I mentioned, these companies are really worried about the punishment which will follow their business with Iran. This is a bunch of lies that they deliver. And I don't know the American policymaker, especially President Trump, they are saying that there is no actually sanction on the health sector, but in reality, we cannot do anything regarding our health sector.
So, Professor, how has Iran managed to cope despite the sanctions? What is Iran doing? What kind of innovations have we seen coming out of this crisis?
At the beginning, we had a lot of problems providing PPE and also ventilators and other necessary consumables and drugs for our patients that really was hurting. But we are not going to sit and surrender. And somehow we thought that we should do something about it. And fourth, especially our knowledge-based companies started their R&D activities, and through technology development, we overcome some of these problems, for example, regarding facial masks, N95, things we had the technology on nanofiber technology, we were able, using nanofiber technology, to produce N95 and even N99 facial masks. At the beginning, our production capacity was about 20,000 masks per day, but fortunately, within 2 weeks, we increased our production capacity in 200,000 masks per day because we had the technology and we were producing the industrial machinery and the production line. And Iran is one of the few countries who have the technology to build up this nanofiber technology, which makes us capable of producing N95 masks. And we are producing all hand sanitizers using nanomaterials like nanosilver particles or titanium oxide particles. And also we are producing air purification. And top scientists managed to make a system for detection of COVID patients. It's called RDS, RAS detector, and within less than 30 seconds, using these nanosensors to detect those who are affected with COVID-19 virus. They dip the nanosensor inside the sputum. If the person is affected with the virus, within 30 seconds, the system will be able to detect the RAS, which is a byproduct of, virus in the lung. So the patients who have lung inflammation, by the virus, this system will immediately detect them.
And Iran has been developing its own COVID vaccine, correct?
Several Iranian companies are engaged in developing COVID-19 vaccine. Several of them are using virus or the kill virus, but two of these companies are using, the edge of the technology, what the technology, and also nanolipid particles to produce vaccines like what, BioNTech and Pfizer or Moderna use the technology. And we hope that within next 6 months, we will be able to start vaccination in Iran by Iranian-made vaccine, the top range of the technology. And fingers crossed, some of the companies have passed even an animal trial, and we need to do the clinical trial on people. And hopefully, we will be able to provide our people with Iranian-made vaccine.
In terms of regular medicines and medication, how much harder have they become to obtain? And how have U.S. sanctions impacted that?
Regarding the regular medicine, we don't have much of the problem because Iranian industry, pharmaceutical industry, is capable of producing ordinary or regular drugs. But regarding special drugs for, special patients in cancer or like hemophilia or some other special disease, there are severe effects on these groups of patients, which they cannot really find these drugs in pharmacies, and they need to go to black market and pay several times more to buy these drugs. So this is really hurting and has put a severe pressure on these innocent patients regarding, this is the result of what the U.S. doing with the ordinary people. And, it's really unbearable.
Doctor, thank you so much for your time and for all your hard work. I really appreciate having you on the show. Thank you so much. The effects of these sanctions on Iran's economy are also undeniable. Just last month, Mike Pompeo was even bragging about how the U.S. has crippled Iran's economy by devaluing its currency, the rial, increasing public debt and inflation, and reducing the number of barrels of oil that the country is able to export. The fact that we regularly see the U.S. Secretary of State gloat about this exposes a shameless imperialist arrogance, how these imperialists are proud of causing the death and destruction of others. And it's important to note how everything is interconnected. Again, while the United States pretends that its sanctions don't target humanitarian goods, this is a flat-out lie and a denial of the reality on the ground and the suffering of countless people that is inflicted by the United States and their allies. Now that Joe Biden has been officially declared the president-elect by the Electoral College, one must ponder what lies next